can everybody hear me? Well, welcome to the second in our Global Civil Society lecture series. We're really lucky tonight to have Saskia Sassen, who is probably very well known to everybody. She's a sociologist. She's written some marvelous books about globalization. She's a professor at the University of Chicago, but also a professor here at the London School of Economics. And she's written a chapter of our Global Civil Society yearbook on global cities and on diasporas and how they meet together and become global civil society in global cities. It's a wonderful chapter, and I recommend you to read it, but you'll get a foretaste of it today with Saskia's lecture. So without any more, I'll introduce Saskia.
I really like the informality of the English. When Mary said, I will introduce Saskia, in the United States this means that on comes 10 minutes of very tedious description of the books, and the speaker then sits there remembering all the deadlines and all the work to be done. So I really, yes. I want to talk about this, and I cannot help, but it started already before we started, the daily life in there. It matters a lot to what I want to talk about. My own daily life, of course, is a phenomenon that we might best describe as space-time compression, which often sort of disappears as a function of traveling across 9 time zones. There is often no daily life. But anyhow, so much for that. What I really would like to address here, and it is a bit of an experiment, and I like to use my talks to experiment intellectually, is to ask the question whether global civil society can actually take place, get constituted at the local level, in localities, around localized concerns, around local actors who engage local enemies or interlocutors. And further, whether global civil society can be constituted in non-cosmopolitan terms. And thinking about that comes a bit out of my effort or my irritation with notions, or my effort to contest notions that if we're dealing with globality, we're dealing with cosmopolitanism. That somehow globality is almost inevitably cosmopolitan. So I do not deny that much of what we call global civil society happens at the global level. Nor do I deny that much of what global civil society is about has to do deeply with cosmopolitanism. But I'm concerned with actors, with organizations that are, so to speak, stuck in the mud, that do not have the opportunity to travel, that do not have the opportunity to circulate, that are so concerned with their own very narrow problems, water, environment, politics, torture, etc., that they are involved in something that, insofar as it is recurrent around the world, can be thought of as at least an element of global civil society. But that is very univocal. It is not cosmopolitan in the sense of containing, mobilizing, deploying multiple logics. The other hand of this is that when I look at the global financial elites that I have worked on, they are very global, but I do not think they're cosmopolitan. They may have cosmopolitan tastes, they may love cosmopolitans, whatever, but when they, insofar as their subjectivity or their acting as global financial elites, they have one logic, and they are not cosmopolitan, even though they're continuously circulating. So I'm trying to find a little in-between zone for activity, for engagement, for ideational issues that I think, but as I said, it's a bit of an experimental talk, that I think is part of global civil society, and that can engage actors that are really localized in their concerns and in their confinements, and that in that sense are non-cosmopolitan. I'm open to a lot of discussion because it is, as I said, an experimental notion. I have a little PowerPoint presentation here, and I am never certain whether these help or detract, because for me it's always more words. There are no real images in there. So one general, if you want, setting or question is this question, whether global civil society can operate at the local level and in non-cosmopolitan terms. The tendency in the literature, the tendency, I would say, in the political debates, is to consider the global only at the self-evident level of the global. The implication, then, is that the local, the locality, are not places, or more, if you want, in a more abstract sense, sites for global civil society. Further, the tendency in the literature is also to think of global civil society as that which can escape the confinements of the national, and to think of that escape not as a purely ideational issue, but actually, especially in the global era, as an opportunity to enact, to transact, etc., in some sort of cross-border zone. If you want, for short, a very common image is to circulate globally. And hence, very often, global civil society is constructed as an ideational formation, if you want. And it is deeply imbued with notions of cosmopolitanism. The implication here, then, is that localized concerns and struggles are not part of global civil society. They are non-cosmopolitan, and non-cosmopolitan cannot possibly be part of global civil society. Now, I want to again emphasize that perhaps it is indeed that way, and maybe history will tell us, but right now my argument is that we don't quite know whether it is that clear, and that non-cosmopolitanism might well be part of global civil society. I use the term non-cosmopolitanism clearly in a relational sense. It sort of indicates, one might say, a poverty of language. You know, I should find another word rather than the non-cosmopolitan. But I want to use non-cosmopolitan because it signals what I am engaging, what I am contesting. And secondly, given the absolute dominance of the notion of cosmopolitanism, given that it has been transformed into an absolute good, you know, if it's cosmopolitan, it's got to be good. And hence, if it's non-cosmopolitan, it's bad. It's fundamentalisms, it's terrorist networks, you name it. There are a lot of very bad variants. And so I'm sort of contesting these binaries and these dualizations. The next question one might ask then, where are the elements that allow us to begin to map this notion that global civil society can get enacted, constituted at the local level and in non-cosmopolitan forms? Now, I mentioned three elements here. They can also be used to map global civil society in global, in the sense of the global scale and in cosmopolitan terms. These are not, they don't preclude each other. They are not mutually exclusive. Here I just want to pull out particular elements that serve my purpose here. The first has to do with a set of issues that come out of the question of globalization and human rights. And here, one sort of summarizing way of describing the matter is to say that globalization and human rights in their own particular ways create operational, legal, rhetorical, whole multiplicity of openings for actors other than the state to enter into cross-border domains once exclusive to national states. And this, to me, is a crucial issue. It's not just entering any cross-border domain. It is precisely this very specific domain, a domain that was once exclusive to national states, you know, which in some narrow sense might have been considered the interstate system. Now, secondly, globalization and human rights also contribute to an incipient and partial unbundling of national state authority over its territory and people. And here what matters for me in this kind of notion is that this unbundling allows rescalings, allows localized actors to jump across what are hierarchies of scale, where the local is nested in the urban, is nested in the regional, is nested in the national. And if the local is to intervene, to participate, to enact a project in the cross-border domain, it's got to filter through these nested hierarchies. So this notion of the unbundling of the partial, incipient, I mean, this is by no means, you know, an absolute process, but this partial unbundling of the national, of national state authority over its territory and its people, is, I think, to me, important in the sense of this rescaling. Now, one might ask at this point, why does this unbundling happen? And here what I'm thinking about is a series of issues that have to do with privatization, with deregulation, all tactics, if you want, that are familiar to anybody who has dealt with globalization, and that basically, if you want, shrink the domain of the state. And in that sense, by shrinking the domain of the state, create this partial unbundling. What was unitary, it never was perfectly unitary, but to some extent it was more unitary, one might argue, than it is today. In terms of private, I just want to dwell a minute on this question of privatization and deregulation, because in a country like the UK, in a country like the US, we have long had deregulated, privatized, etc., zones where the state cannot easily participate. But I think that even in those countries, something has happened over the last 15 years that is really very, very significant, and that takes it beyond an older history. Secondly, in much of the world, privatization and deregulation have been enormously dramatic conditions. And we in the UK, we in the US may not sense, may not experience this unbundling. But believe me, and many of you know this, in many parts of the world, this is an in-your-face sort of project. I always like, in the case of the United States, sort of when I'm talking to American audiences, who experientially, if you want, have a hard time sensing the transformation, I'd like to mention the case of prisons, which is to me a very sort of, it makes legible the issues. And as some of you know, prisons have, there are many prisons that are now private operations, basically, in the United States. Now, the prison is supposed to be a state system. When a prison becomes a private operation, the operators operate that prison as if it were a hotel. You know, each prisoner is the equivalent of a paying guest. So, you know, the more prisoners, the better. You understand that? Now, this is a very, very minor shift in the project that is incarceration. Now, it's minor, institutionally speaking, and sort of, you know, what you think of it. For the people involved, it may be major. And there is an interpretation in the United States that the growth of incarceration, that the strengthening of the punishment, if you want, is not completely unconnected to this fact that more and more prisons are now private operations. So I just want, with this story, what I want to emphasize is that this question of privatization operates in many very subtle ways, and not only sort of in very dramatic and clear, you know, public sector firm becomes private. There are many, many ways in which this shift is significant. I should maybe mention another example. I often find that people are not totally clear as to what exactly privatization really is beyond the fact that a public sector firm becomes private, for instance. If you take the case of a public sector firm becoming private, I have often argued that what happens here is much more than a change in ownership regime going from public to private. What you also have is a shift and a dressing up in truly different clothes of what were public regulatory functions into private specialized services for firms. Now, this makes a lot of difference, because this firm that has become private does not cease to have regulatory issues attached to it. It has them. But these regulatory issues are now produced in terms of the interests of the firm and the actual content of the regulatory project is specialized legal services, special accounting services, etc. We, moreover, now also know that accountants are enormously creative, in fact, more creative than many artists whom I know. and so we really need to think of privatization as a very subtle but thick process that alters a whole number of little building blocks. When I speak of unbundling, I mean a whole range of these processes, some of which are micro and not very legible, some of which are very big, and we all immediately know what it is that we're talking about. Now, the third element here is something that has to do with network technologies. And here my argument, again, what I'm trying to map is the possibility that global civil society is actually constituted in terms of localized, etc., and non-cosmopolitan. And so what matters about this point of network technologies is something, and I will return to it later, something that has to do with the fact that given this kind of interconnectivity, given cheap access, localized groups can have two things happen to them or they make them happen. One of them is to become aware, and here notions of globality, partly as ideational spaces matter, to become aware that the struggles that they are engaged in are recurrent in place to place after place around the world. Secondly, they can become, through cheap, you know, internet access, etc., they can become parts of global networks that are constituted not by scaling upward, like an electronic financial market, but by, again, connecting on a lateral level, place after place after place after place. So in that sense, they can be participants in the global and participants in forms of globality without scaling upward to some level that is sort of self-evidently global. They can remain localized. So these are the three elements that I want to emphasize as elements that allow one to map this aspect of global civil society at a different level. This issue of openings for new types of actors in global civil societies is in global civil society is very important for the argument that I'm making about the possibility of localized and non-cosmopolitan actors to become of part of global civil society. The first point that I make here is that even resource-poor organizations and individuals can participate in various types of cross-border politics through the internet and general infrastructure of globalization. So in that sense, this question of the new technologies is enormously significant. It does not mean that everybody can access, that all resource-poor organizations can, but it does mean that a resource-poor organization, a resource-poor individual, does not need to be kept out of these kinds of global politics. It may well be the case that the majority of resource-poor organizations are kept out. But we all know such organizations, poor individuals, that have access to cheap connectivity and that have sort of, and as I mentioned before, that second element is very important, this ideational zone where globality emerges as something that people can somehow identify with. Second point, this notion, I'm just elaborating, that involvement in localized efforts can be part of global networks connecting multiple such localized efforts. You do not have to scale at the global level to be part of this global civic engagement. Now, is global civic engagement the same as global civil society? That is a question that I think partly the answer will require some level of theorization. You know, it's not just an empirical question, and I think that it's also a question of history in the making. We will actually discover whether global civic networks are, in some sense, also global civil society. I'm not sure of that right now. To me, that is a bit of a question.
But what we do know is that you can have these global civic networks. And here what I'm thinking of, just to illustrate a bit, I'm thinking of human rights activists, the kind, not the kind that goes to glittering, you know, money-raising dinners, etc. You know, no, I'm talking about people who are obsessed, overwhelmed, full-time engaged with maybe 2 torture cases, 3 prisoners in a locality here, in a locality there, etc. I'm talking about people who are deeply engaged in their localized condition. Environmental activists who are obsessed with the water quality in their neighborhood, with that particular tree or that particular owl, with this particular fish pond. In other words, I'm bringing it down to very, very concrete, very localized, but conditions that recur time after. Different such localities. And through that recurrence, which is a lateral phenomenon rather than a scaling up to some sort of vertical locus, through that lateral recurrence constitutes something akin to global civic networks. We could call them global human rights networks, etc., but I'm just using civic in a fairly general sense here. And in that case, then, these specific narrow objectives that can be part of global networks and initiatives, the condition is, I think, recurrence. If it is an absolutely singular case, a case that happens only in one place, then I don't think that we're dealing with a global civic network. If it recurs in place after place, I think we can begin to capture this, to conceptualize this as global civic networks. Now, these non-cosmopolitan forms of enacting global civil society, for me, are precisely captured by these cases that I described. And yes, human rights is a universal regime. Yes, environmental issues and struggles get at sort of universals. That is correct. But at the same time, there are versions of the fight for human rights, the fight for the environment, that are very localized, that are very particular, that are very concrete. And those are the ones that I'm trying to capture. Again, I see in the literature a tendency to take the highest level, the most encompassing level, which is often indeed very abstract, and one might say very cosmopolitan. There are multiple logics at work. When you look at human rights activists close to the ground, when you look at environmental activists close to the ground, there often is one logic. One particular purpose. And in that sense, as I said before, global financial elites are not unlike that. They have one purpose. We can call it in some fancy term, or we can call it in very plain language, making money in many different ways and through many different channels, but one logic. And for me, cosmopolitanism is something that is constituted via multiple logics. There is a level of complexity, there is an architecture. Otherwise, it's not, for me, cosmopolitan. So when I talk about human rights activism, when I talk about environmental activism, when I talk about all kinds of different kinds of activism, there has got to be, which are really very focused on one particular issue, these are the kinds of actors that I'm calling non-cosmopolitan human rights activists, environmental activists, even though human rights, I repeat, and the environment are universal categories. And so I think that one of the issues that we're dealing with is a poverty of language. We use one term to capture an enormous variety of conditions. For the purposes of many inquiries, that does not matter. That's fine. For the purposes of this kind of inquiry that I'm after, it actually does matter. Now, there is a particular kind of network that I'm interested in pursuing here briefly, and that is diasporic networks. And one of my arguments, and this is partly a hypothesis, this is partly a hunch, you know, this is a thought that I'm interested in, is that between globalization and digital connectivity, you know, the internet, etc., whatever form. I say the internet because it's the most familiar version of it, and it's a cheap version very often. Enable, or push, actually, towards a reconfiguring of immigrant networks. Not all immigrant networks, but one way of describing that is there is a capability, there is the possibility of reconfiguring immigrant networks. And the reconfiguring that I'm interested in understanding is a reorienting that goes largely from being sort of addressing country of origin, that is the typical condition, to one, which is a one-to-one relationship, to one that begins to think itself as part of a globalized diaspora. Why does globalization matter, and why do human and why do digital technologies matter here? Because what we're talking about when we talk about globalized diasporas is the possibility that you have three individuals in that town, two in this country, five here, very small numbers of individuals who can begin to think themselves as part of this global network. And at least two conditions that it takes, it seems to me, is this notion of a globality, something about globality. And the second one, this digital connectivity, that they can go online, they can visit the site, they can signal, here I am. So in that sense, the formation of a globalized diaspora, where before it was a one-to-one relationship, immigrant community to country of origin. Many immigrant communities, but all in a radial fashion to country of origin. Now, this has multiple implications, because one implication is, again, if you want, the common term that one might use here is a deterritorializing of, you know, something about the notion of membership. In the case of immigrants, it very often is national, though it can also be subnational or regional, but something about dislodging the experience of membership from the actual terrain, the territory of the home country. So there are many things happening. In terms of what I'm interested in understanding is that it feeds into this unbundling of state authority, the authority of the state over its territory and its people, because these are now constituting themselves, these groups of people, as globalized diasporas, even if there are only three here and two here, etc., etc. And I'm interested. Well, that is different. And I, that's right, no, it sounds like somebody is playing some drums there. Can you hear me and it? This is very. Do we have the technical person? Oh, it passes. It's a mobile. Anybody has a mobile? All right. So the second aspect of this unbundling is that the nation state, it's not just that it loses authority, it's that the nation state as a site for the constituting of an identity, in this case a national identity or a regional identity, etc., ceases to be the crucial anchor that it was. Now this lies, what I just described, I think lies in the future. We are not quite there, but it's beginning to happen. Oh no. Is anybody here in charge of anything that... No? So, one way of thinking about this is that you have multiple lateral networks that are repositioning the experience of community of membership. And this, I think, again, is sort of a way of rethinking the question of the nation, nationality, territory, and hence national state. In that sense, diasporic networks begin to dislodge their project from an exclusive focus of some sort of home country, whether real, actual, or mythical, and begin to sort of create a far more diffuse condition, if you want. Well, I don't know. Can you hear me as I keep on speaking or not? Yes, well. What are the places where we can actually read these actions, where we can see something happening. There are many kinds of places. Something happening along these lines of the localizing, the non-cosmopolitan, etc., etc. I, given my research history, etc., have been particularly interested in large cities. As a consequence, I tend to think that large cities, especially global cities, are sites, are locations that make many of these processes legible, but they are also locations that are productive of these processes. And here there is a whole issue. The fact that urban space, to be that, it has to be productive. And so one of the issues that I'm looking at is to what extent one of the forms of productivity of urban space today has to do with enabling these particular kinds of enactments that I'm talking about. And let me just run through a couple of distinctive markers of urban space as a way to sort of position the argument. First, the fact that urban space makes possible very concrete types of politics. It is radically different from national political space, which is highly formalized, where you have to be a citizen, you have to be a formal subject to participate, etc., etc. Urban space is messy. Urban space can accommodate informal actors, non-formalized actors, actors that might never be formalized. Undocumented immigrants can be part of urban street politics. They cannot really be part of formal political systems. So there is something about urban space, especially in a large city, and I really think that large cities matter because they are a bit anarchic, because they can accommodate all kinds of possibilities that, say, a suburban space could not, where the level of surveillance, the level of homogeneity is very high, et cetera, and notions of social order are of a very specific kind. So it seems to me that if I look at the global city, which is an extreme form of this urban space, I see that they are productive, a space, of two crucial agents or actors in today's societies. And I see this, frankly, also in the global south, not only in the global north. One of them is global capital, which I don't really want to talk about now. This is the whole global city analysis, et cetera, et cetera. But the other one is this amalgamated, not quite fully formalized actor that also finds in the space of the city a space wherein which it can produce its political operations, its political enactments, etc. Again, crucial dimension hanging in all of this is this notion that when we're talking about urban space, we're talking about something that is productive. It is not just, you know, some sort of stretch of terrain within which you have streets and houses and public places. No. When I speak of urban space, I mean something that has very distinctive features. The economic global city function is one that has to do with the enablement of certain aspects of global corporate capital, etc., etc. This, when I'm talking about it now, about how it connects to issues of global civil society, I'm trying to understand to what extent this kind of space can actually produce a type of subject, a type of political subjectivity that is somehow, or that captures, if you want, some of these localized activisms that I was talking about, some of these elements of a localized, non-cosmopolitan global civil society. A crucial issue here is this notion of a diversity of population and causes. There are few places like cities for finding people from all over the world, for finding all kinds of causes. Many people with a cause do go to a city. They like a city because you can do a lot of stuff in a city. And here I want to get to something that has to do with the distinction within, well, between power and powerlessness, which veils or evicts a crucial element in this dynamic that I'm trying to describe. And that is, I think that the fact of diversity, the fact of concrete political sort of struggle, work, pro- project, etc., in the space of the city, strengthens something that we might call lateral recognition. If it's a homogeneous group in a suburb where you have one very powerful firm, lateral recognition is naturalized. We're all the same. We're all the workers who are oppressed, we're all this, we're all that. In a city, so you may have something, you know that you need housing, you are against gentrification, you are for the rights of immigrants, etc. But you're dealing with populations that are enormously mixed. So it forces, it makes in a way, it produces, and in that sense is productive of, a capacity, a disposition towards lateral recognition. Besides the far easier vertical recognition, you know, the enemy, the other, the powerful, the landlord, the police brutality, all of that. Now, this lateral recognition, I think, produces a kind of, if you want, political architecture in these masses who might be very poor, very disenfranchised, or they might not be so poor or not so disenfranchised. It does not give them power, but I think it produces something. Again, I'm concerned about the kind of productivity. And I call what it produces presence. Presence towards each other, and presence also, of course, towards power. And it seems to me that when you're disadvantaged, when you're poor, when you're oppressed, when you're localized, when you are non-cosmopolitan, when you're all of these kinds of things that I've been talking about, you may or may not have this political disposition. But under certain conditions, this political disposition that is not power, but that is something, again, that I'm calling presence, does occur. It seems to me that this kind of notion, when you become aware, you who are localized, you who are concerned with very particular issues, but you are forced by the setting, by, if you want to use the abstract term now, urban space, to engage in lateral recognition of those others, etc. That this is a first step, if you want, towards something that has to do with articulating, if you want, with global civic concerns. The globality in this case starts with a very localized globality. It is the globality that is constituted through all of these differences, etc. The work of being able to engage in this lateral recognition is, however, work that puts you on a road, if you want, towards something that begins to engage global civil society. And in the case of certain particular groups, it does. If you're activists, etc., the global networks I was talking about, it is happening. But I want to take it just a bit more generally and to ask the question, well, to what extent can it be a more diffuse condition, this thing that we call global civil society, that gets enacted in these places? And it doesn't just have to be cities. I just choose cities because I think they're particularly productive of the possibility that I'm alluding to. So I repeat, to what extent can it be a far more diffuse condition? A condition, in other words, that is part of daily life, that is not setting yourself up with a clear project, with a substantive rationality. I am engaging in these human rights whatever, or this environmental, and I am part of global networks, that absolutely sort of self-knowing and very rationalized, if you want. But a more diffuse presence that is more elusive, that is not as legible, if you want, than if you're standing out there and saying, you know, I'm this. And in that sense, the question is, to what extent are some of the building blocks of global civil society actually enacted in daily life, in a diffuse fashion, in very specific places, producing experiences or let's say resulting from experiences that are caught up in daily life where we don't see the drama of global civil society. Now, if you want, there are two extreme conditions and one intervening condition. The extreme condition is the notion of global civil society as a cosmopolitan event, as a very ideational space, you know, and of course many of us in this room, that's, you know, that's probably who we are. The intermediate condition are the global civic networks that I talked about, engaged in very particular issues. The globalizing of diasporas that used to be on a one-to-one, right? Where there is already a self-recognition, an explication, a rationalizing, there is an experience, and here, again, the question of globality matters. But then there is a third site, and that third site is some notion of a diffuse presence that is not nuts and bolts, aha, here we have global civil society, no, that is much more diffuse, but that eventually, in fact, begins to become part of global civil society, but under very particular conditions. And that is, it gets enacted in daily life or in the situations of daily life, and it gets enacted with a very diffuse project, if you want, not with a very particular and well-defined project. Now, I think that the way I'm describing this, politics is a crucial part. But I mean politics in the sense of a political subjectivity, of the notion that we're all subjects, we're all, each of us is multiple subjects. And this notion of global civil society going from the self-evidently global and cosmopolitan through the nuts and bolts, narrow focus, etc., you know, activist network, global civic networks, globalized diasporas, to this more diffuse issue, clearly deploys, mobilizes, entails politics in very different fashions. But I wonder, and I want to end with this question, whether we can have something that we can call global civil society at whatever level of these three very sort of exaggerated levels that I just used for illustration here, whether we can have global civil society without having this question of politics, this question of the conditions that can produce a certain kind of subjectivity. If it is indeed the case that the political, not the political as in highly formalized systems, as in, you know, I'm a citizen, on the contrary, a far deeper and more diffuse kind of politics, if the political is indeed part of what we call global civil society, but you understand that what I'm playing with here is I'm contesting a bit the distinction that the civil society is not part of a formal political system. It is enabled by a formal political system. It can influence, but it is distinct. I find that a very different notion. And I care about this notion of the political because I think, I may be wrong about this, but I think that the very disadvantaged, the very disenfranchised can have access to the political on some level, but it's not going to be formal politics. And I wonder to what extent, and again, here globality and globalization matter as sort of enabling conditions and very much as ideational spaces. I wonder to what extent notions such as multitude, you know, the category that has been circulating wildly all over the place, they are, to me, multitude is a very depoliticized category, a very uncritical category. And so, but what I like about it is that it is sort of a synthesizing move within which I would situate multiple complex political architectures, such as what I tried to describe here very briefly, that then begin to flesh out this very abstract notion and very, I would say, critical gaze-like or uncritical gaze-like category that is the multitude. I don't know if I lost some of you on that last point there, but So the questions with which I want to conclude are two. One is the possibility of a diffuse experience of global civil society in under conditions of daily life, the sites, if you want, of daily life. The second one is whether in order for that to happen, politics and a certain kind of political subjectivity actually needs to be part of it. It cannot only be material practices. There is something else that needs to be part. And I called it a disposition. I called it the production of lateral recognitions. I called it the experience of presence. But something that is not simply a material practice, like participating in global civic networks or something. So, well, I will just leave you with these questions. Thank you very much for your attention.
to thank Saskia for a very stimulating and thought-provoking lecture. I think this is such an important issue because global civil society has to take place somewhere, whether it's Davos or Porto Alegre or in the heart of Chicago.
Right.
And so thinking about what that somewhere is, I think Saskia's done a wonderful job in helping us to think about that. I have masses of questions, but before I ask them, I'm going to ask everybody else what questions you would like to ask. Okay, Ulrich Beck.
Thank you, Saskia. Well, if I did understand you right, I think you, picking up your first statement, you have some experimental approach in trying to map some of the new realities we are engaged with and trying to, well, give actually some rhetoric or some language, a new language, in order to just point at those elements. And I think we all have the same problem, as you said. We are using all kind of terms with all kind of meanings and get in all kind of problems in using them. Well, this has been a very general statement so far. But it's important because, you know, on the one hand, we are, to some extent, in a new land now. We have a new landscape which we have to structure by a new language to some extent, and we are captured in those old concepts and we are fighting with them and so on. So this, I think we have very common problems in trying to communicate about new realities with old concepts and trying to find our way through. Well, the problem I have is just when you begin in identifying the global as something which is just globally, as you can just recognize it globally. The global can only be recognized globally, and then you oppose yourself that there has to be some local or some engagement on a more daily life basis. But couldn't you say, just generally speaking, you are talking against an enemy image about the global, which isn't true anyway. Could there be any global engagement just on the global level, just for itself? Isn't it something which is actually which we should have to deny very general level? We are talking about the global in global terms, but what does it really mean? So actually, isn't it? Aren't we always in a position when we talk about globalization, not in a language which doesn't have any concrete meaning, that we have to adapt it to some local perspective as well?
Yeah.
And isn't it always a mixture between, let's say, local networks or networks in between and globality? Mm-hmm. And I think, well, if we agree on this... But I think you still... We're pretty much putting the term cosmopolitan close to the concept of the global and globality, didn't you?
Globality.
Globality, yes. It's somehow...
The other way around, actually, that those who talk about globality
presume
a bit that if it's global, it's got to be cosmopolitan in some ways. You know, it's transcending the national.
But, you know...
Rather than the other direction.
Of course, there are always these different meanings we have in mind. But, you know, cosmopolitan, to me at least, means pretty much related to the local as well. It's just about these mixtures of...
Yeah, but you're a special case.
Okay. But, you know, well, of course, we are all, to some extent, special cases. But still, you know, this is the first question I have, how you relate to...
Yes.
Aren't you talking about a general problem?
I understand that.
Well, we're very lucky having already here.
All right. Let me address... first... I speak of the global scale. And by scale, I mean practices, logics, substantive rationalities, etc., that get constituted at the global scale. A scale is not just, you know, a taxonomy that I put on top of, you know. A scale is actually, and I do believe that throughout history we have had that scaling. But that in the last 15 years, it has strengthened. So now, is it an absolute? Can it exist by itself? is another question. And there I would agree with you. But I do think, I've worked enough on electronic markets, you know, financial markets, that I do believe that there is a scaling that gets constituted at that global level. So I would say, yes, there are arrangements, configurations, formations that can actually be partly material, or that can be ideational, or that can be, you know, digital, etc., that are self-evidently, as I say, with a bit of irony, you know, but, you know, that we all say, oh, well, that's of course global. Now, the question, the way I would reformulate your question to me is to say, is that scaling self-sufficient? Does it need to be embedded, actually, in a whole set of other settings? And there, I mean, a lot of my work has, in fact, been to demonstrate that, in fact, there are complex, you know, forms of embeddedness, et cetera, including electronic markets, including digital formations are embedded. But that is a bit different from saying that the global always somehow is connected to the local, because I want to actually complexify it. And I want to say there are these scalings, and we do not gain by mushing it all up and saying, oh, well, you know, if you have the global, you're going to have the local. And one of the questions I have, I mean, it's again, it's not a question to which I have an answer, but I think that scalar dynamics are a very significant factor that happens with globalization, in a way that they were not in the period when the national state is dominant, which is, of course, the exception in our long history. You know, so on some level, there were imperial spatialities and scalings, you know, before we had the national state, et cetera, et cetera. So I would try to capture that scaling. Now, global civil society, it seems to me that there is a sense in which global civil society is partly understood to be at that scale, you know, as escaping the confinements of the national. The language of the scalar is not used, because the language of the scalar, this is a new kind of analytics that is now emerging to really take this very seriously. But I mean, you know, the literature of global society is huge. It comes in, I swear, 250 languages. I exaggerate, of course, but it's very difficult. And I am not necessarily an expert as such on global civil society. I've not spent my life on that. But when you sort of pick up this issue, and especially when you enter the domain of the cosmopolitan and globality, etc., it seems to me that there is a naturalizing, perhaps, of that global scaling, but that it is there, you know? So I don't know if I answered your question. In other words, it's not that I disagree, but I disagree in that particular issue that I want to really capture the specific of that global scaling. That global scale. That is what I would say.
Well, I can now see that Richard also has a question. Actually, I thought, since this is now turning into a seminar format, and I hope it's interesting for everybody, that I would also like to add my question, which was very much along Urich's lines.
Yes.
Because you said at some point that cosmopolitanism for you was a relational concept. And I think that, well, for me, and I think, of course, mine is similar to Ulrich, it's an ideational concept. It's a normative concept. And what it's about is a commitment to human equality, but also respect for the diversity of cultures. Right. And I have a feeling that the way you were using the term cosmopolitan was in terms of those guys who fly around in...
No, the opposite. Yeah. The opposite. I said the global financial elites are not cosmopolitan.
Oh, okay.
They have a single logic. For me, the cosmopolitan, I mean, one way, this is a very abstract way, yeah, that there are multiple logics. It gets messy, it gets complicated, there are complex architectures in there. And in that sense, the possibility of the productivity, if you want, in there, is that you can escape the narrow confines of something. The national is typically what we often think of, you know what I mean? But no, the global financial elites are not. They may be global.
Yeah.
They are global. But they are not cosmopolitan.
Okay, they are not for me.
They
but
are.
I would nevertheless say that something
the normative
like
issue
Davos,
is,
for example, where the global financial elite meets NGOs and political
right.
leaders, is typically global civil society.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So you definitely have and for me a non-cosmopolitan would be particularist, somebody who acts
right.
in particular interests. And it seems to me global civil society, if it's to be a forum for deliberation right. about global issues, can be anywhere as, yes. And can include cosmopolitanism and non-cosmopolitanism.
Right, I agree. I agree with that. But I want to clarify one issue. When the financiers, I used to go to Davos, when the demonstration started, I said, never again. I once crossed a picket line protected by seven military types. I said, never again. I felt so bad doing that. But anyhow, when those financiers go there, they are not functioning simply as financiers. They are different than when they're making a deal. They're precisely there to be, if you want, educated, right? And to talk about politics and to meet the politicians and to... So that is indeed a site where I prefer calling it the denationalizing of elites takes place, media elites. You know, I like certain precise definitions. I don't want to use global civil society just for anything. Now, you said normative versus relational. I think that is an interesting point that you're making, because it's true that I don't have much of a normative issue in there. But it's not relational either. But the normative issue, I think that is where I sort of don't quite get into the stuff of global civil society as it is usually, that it is good, right? It is good. I am keeping I just want to go digging a bit more. But and that is why I don't want to leave those who are stuck in the mud, those who are not going to Davos or Porto Alegre, or who, I don't want to leave them behind in this possibility of the constructing of something. But that is why I do think that the intermediation is politics. It can't just be the water. It's got to have that ideational element to it. And that is what I meant by the political. It cannot, you know, be et cetera, et cetera. And the question hence, do global civic networks, are they global civil society? It's a question to me. But anyway, this is, you know, this is how I work the materials always. I'm these incredibly complex little mappings in the grids, and hopefully it produces something. Now, do we want to...
I'm going to ask other questions. Richard, yes. No? Would you like to ask? You want to go
ahead. There are questions there.
Contribution to precisely that literature that tends to equate cosmopolitanism and globalism, but then you maybe inadvertently, paradoxically accept this premise by calling it non-cosmopolitan.
Well, I think
by looking at the importance of localization as a constitutive aspect of cosmopolitanism, you would escape all this semantic stuff, and you would give cosmopolitanism what I think is your intention, the meaning, by calling it non-cosmopolitan, you engage with the straw man that you want to actually get away from.
I agree, and that is, Mary, where I used relational.
Yeah.
I said, because I am trying to position, at this point, it's a debate. It's a contestation. And so I want to make very clear what it is. And I also said, it's a question. You know, but you are right. In the long term, it's a poverty of language, and also it creates a sort of a straw manish quality that I don't really need. But at this point, it actually facilitates the discussion. You know, in a way.
Richard,
shall
sorry,
we take
we've got,
some?
We've got a little phalanx in the front, and then I'm going to come to everybody else.
Well, I just wanted to remark that the cosmopolitan originally had two meanings. One was that a cosmopolitan was someone who was very well endowed with what we would call social or cultural capital. The other was the meaning which was used in the 19th century by Balzac and Flaubert, was someone who had the capacity to cut free from the life project of a place and reconstitute the life project within themselves. And it seems to me that that second version of cosmopolitanism is liberating. And I think, in a way, what you're talking about, Saskia, is a different kind, is more a kind of Balzacian cosmopolitanism of projects that are, whether they're done in a small village or a large city, or indeed when you travel, but the notion that you're focused on something which is not related to the norms of this nest. Right? The breakout is the breakout in terms of practicing a project which is specific. which doesn't get its meaning by being nested. And that is that other, more politically emancipatory notion of the cosmopolitan.
That's right. And that means that you can be very poor and not go on a plane and be part of that. That you don't have to somehow sort of, you know, leave the conditions of your own confinement, materially speaking. And I mean, and in that sense, the political for me is the ideational, the normative. I have trouble with the normative, you see here, because, you know, what norms are we instituting? Who has the power to decide that these are the norms? Who constitutes that normative? Whereas if I make it into politics and a diffuse kind of political practice, I give a chance to those, you know, who are, I don't know, the less advantaged, less resourced. But I think that is very, very helpful, actually, that distinction, the Balzac versus the other distinction. It would be very funny in my kind of paper to be citing Balzac as the source, but, you know, I can I can live with that.
Okay. Who else would like to ask a question? You've been... we seem to be only... I'll come to you, but I'll have some... I know you. You're in my class.
Well, my question will be going into a tangent, and the answer might be obvious, but I just want to hear the answer from you. How can a global civic network existing across a certain diaspora make people that are not necessarily members of the global civic network, how can it make those people feel part of the diaspora / movement, and how can it effectively influence them politically?
Okay. First, the diasporic network is a very particular kind of network. And I actually was referring here to a different type of network from what I called global civic network. Because a diasporic network is constituted partly through some notion of a community of membership, et cetera, in terms of the national. The global civic network is a different kind of network. It is the activists, et cetera, where there is a recurrence of the issues in country after country, locality after locality. Now, every now and then, they might overlap. But the truth of the matter is that they're two different kinds. The diasporic network I wanted to emphasize a bit because it is supposedly constructed in terms of one nation, whether that is, you know, a national state, whether that is a mythical nation, whether that is a subnational ethnic group, whatever it might be, right? And hence is a tough nut to crack here because it produces itself in terms of a very particular community of membership, national, and hence could be seen as the opposite of anything having to do with global civil society. My argument is that from being on a one-to-one with country of origin, the mythic nation, whatever it might be, they now become globalized diasporas. So you have a few individuals here, a few there, and they can begin, and it's a different configuration of the diasporic network, which begins to de-emphasize the Heimat, the home country, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And in that sense, it's a very particular kind of network that is almost, one could say, a test case in terms of some of the variables that I'm using here. Yeah? So you're right when you ask, how can that be? Pretty difficult, because they're two very different configurations. Yeah.
Okay, here we are.
Just a very simple question, an example, if that fits into your description, an example of a European Alevi Academy, which was founded in 2000, and I was introduced to the president who lives himself in the Netherlands, where part of the small community was, another part lives in the UK, where an Alevi Cultural Centre was only founded 5 years ago, plus another, the academy was founded in Germany, in some village somewhere in the middle of nowhere, where people came together and said, we have to get together somehow and form a unit. So this is, would this be an example of you, of these processes you've just described in terms of locals in at least three localities developing their own groups and bringing together one big community called what was just brought in, which will develop into something bigger. Their agenda is fighting, specifically politically, fighting for more political recognition, etc., for Alevis.
It might well be. You know, I would have to know more about it. It's partly an empirical question, but it could be an instance, a micro-level instance of what I'm describing. But I'm not sure. I'm not sufficiently familiar with the case, and the microphone was producing a lot of echo,
So I wasn't quite totally hearing everything you said. But the fact that that there are multiple sites involved and that there is a network is not enough to specify what I'm trying to describe. Because there has to be this, because I'm talking about lateral networks, there has to be the recurrence of the issue, so that very different localized groups, as opposed to, say, a network of affiliates of a corporation, that's a different kind of story. Yes?
Okay. You still want to ask your question?
Okay.
So the gentleman in the front.
I found it very interesting that the way you were pushing these separate groups to their very specific causes to a state of abstraction, so that it almost seemed you were pushing for a kind of currency that those lateral networks could deploy that would be similar to the currency you named very easily for the vertical non-cosmopolitan network of the financial elites, which was money, and that it seemed you were moving towards the possibility of some kind of abstraction of all their little requirements as the financial elites abstract all their little transactions into money that could be for the lateral networks a usable currency or something.
That is a very interesting suggestion, actually. And I think you're just making me think.
Is it presence?
Okay, presence, right. Presence is one, I was just thinking about it. Presence is one thing where that is cannot be reduced to the sum of the little components that are happening there. Something happens. But I was also thinking that when I'm talking about global civil society, I am talking about the equivalence, I hadn't thought about it, just, you know, of that thing that money is in the multiple microtransactions of the financial elites that then produces something, that value added. The value added in this case that I'm talking about is precisely something that has to do with the global civic. Now, the big question for me, and maybe because I'm a sociologist, when do we run into global civil society? Because the global civic, to me, is a slightly different notion from global civil society, which is already an architecture, a construction. The global civic might be the value added equivalent to money. Money by itself is not either the end of the story in the financial end. We don't want to push the analogy too much, but it's actually a very interesting way of thinking. So what I would answer then is that there is presence at the level of concrete, you know, interaction, the forcing of lateral recognition. And there is a global civic information at that global scale, if you want, that is, however, constituted through these lateral, through these horizontal networks.
Okay. So, more questions. One over there.
I welcome very much and applaud the concepts, abstract as they still are, but then you did say that this was more a conversation. Particularly because the idea of the local is dismissed too often, if not almost wholly, by the political, in the political dialogue, as being parochial, limited, narrow-minded, and almost irrelevant, and is spoken of mostly and dealt with in a cynical way, and dismissed using pejorative language. So it's most important, I think, that we should concentrate this dialogue on the meaning and substance of the local in its cumulative potential for the global. But we have still to find what you called either the language or the architecture in order to do that. Am I right as far as I go?
Yes, though I would not preclude the specificity of that global scaling, all right? I'm very keen, it's not global as such, it's a scaling of the global. It's actually practices, institutional orders, substantive rationalities. So I won't keep that, but the other, except for that, what you said, yes, and also that I didn't use a phrase, but it's a good one. It's like the cumulative, you know, that the local can in fact cumulate, and that will make a difference, that something comes out of that, which is not simply the local or the sum of locals.
Right. No, I'm not disparaging the global. I'm saying that we only have the global.
Yeah.
And indeed, the word I normally use instead of bundling is the aggregation. But an aggregation at different and hierarchical levels of need. Now, this to me is not the invention of a new language, but is the rediscovery of a natural order which has all but disappeared because of the predominance of global technology of information and of communication. Would you agree with that?
Well, that's a very big statement. You know, I'd have to unpack it. I'm not going to do that now. But the only qualifier I would bring into that is something I've just been doing in my sort of attempt to understand scalar and to develop scalar analytics. I have inevitably gone to a whole literature produced by natural scientists, which has to do with ecological, so, you know, the butterfly effect. So the little butterfly, nothing here, and at the global level, disasters, right? So that this question of scaling, I find that an enormously useful analytics. So when you just say now, it's all due to globalization, I have to stop and say, let me check out the scaling. It may well be a lot of, you know, am I not explaining myself? Okay, you said the destruction of the environment, et cetera, due to global technology. I don't know what global technology might mean. That's too general a term for me to simply say, yes, you're right.
But the cancellation of geography, for the importance of intermediate geography, below the global level, that's part of the
reason. Well, but the butterfly effect might suggest that the little geography here might matter a lot, and the destruction little here, and get you to some sort of, you know, that is, the point here is this question of the scaling that allows you to play with a certain rigor, if you want, between the local and a variety of other scales. You're a geographer? No.
Now I have a question over here.
I wonder, Mary, whether we should just collect two or three more questions.
Yeah,
and then
let me just see, because I think that we've almost come to the end. But
yes.
Let me just see how many other people still want to ask a question. Okay, so why don't we take these two and then finish.
Right.
I wonder if you can refer to one of the examples you gave earlier and talk about the global in financial markets, or put simply, what makes them global, according to your scheme?
Okay, fine. Yes.
And then the question over here.
I'm just wondering if there's somewhat of a disconnect between the ways global cities are constituted through finance and things like that and hierarchical networks and this lateral connection, which seems to operate in a different way and is not as grounded in the global cities and can exist anywhere across.
Right. Oh, I thought you were saying the localized lateral recognition bit that I was talking about. You know, you have the global civic network. All right, on the global financial markets, the question was in what sense they are global, right? Well, they are global in at least two senses. One of them is that they constitute networks that have lifted out of very localized situations in financial centers. And there is something that we might call electronic financial markets. There is a global capital market, et cetera, et cetera. That is a moment in a very complex architecture. Again, it comes back to this question of the scale. There is a specificity to that moment. And I use the language of scaling for short, in terms of saying there are practices, there are institutional arrangements, these are increasingly institutionalized and increasingly thick environments that are scaling at the global level. But in terms of the global financial market, that is one moment in a complex architecture that in fact also has another form of global scaling, which is a network of multiple financial markets. Now, what's the difference? Here's the difference. Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, Seoul, Taipei, they're all part of that global network. They are interacting, producing, delivering capital, money, et cetera, et cetera, it's global. At this global level, there is a power project, that enters the picture, that produces a difference compared to the thing that happens with all these networks of financial markets. And that difference I want to capture. Now, you know, I am going into the finer points here. You know, on some level, you can stand back and say, you know what? It's all a power project. Right, it is. But so that is one way of describing a difference. Now, there are other elements. Now, with your, it's not a question simply that capital, the global capital part, is a hierarchy, a vertical hierarchy. It's that also, it's the network. So part of that scaling installs itself in global cities. The hierarchy in the network of global cities comes from that second dimension. That scaling of the electronic global financial market installs itself when the power project enters the picture, so to speak, in a way that is highly unequal and reverberates back, if you want, on each of those financial centers. So it's not just a question of a hierarchy, it's also a network there. The global civic activist networks, etc., I mean, that, you know, that has multiple locales. It doesn't even have to be in global cities. When I talked about this question of the productivity of urban space in terms of this sort of lateral recognition forcing the urban dweller into recognizing laterally, not just seeing power, you know, the landlord or whatever you're fighting to, but that is a localized event. It may be global through recurrence, but it is contained. The global civic network is just a more, you know, the human rights activist may be in some place that is not necessarily a global city. So it's just a different kind of formation. There are two different political dynamics in a way. But I use that second one to suggest something about a more diffuse quality through which the global civic, etc., may get deployed, you know, in the society that is that city. I'm using the language society here, the language of society very, very loosely. Do I answer your question? Yes? Okay. Well, shall we
I'm gonna thank everybody very much, because I think even if it was very abstract, it was a very stimulating and useful discussion, and I think what Saskia is doing is really important. This whole idea of the embeddedness of global civil society is for me really important. Just a couple of announcements before I make a very big thank you to Saskia. One is, if you want to read Saskia's chapter, you can get the Global Civil Society yearbook. You can actually download it from our website, but even better, if you buy a copy outside, you get a free copy from last year. So that's a little bit of promotion. The second is that this is part of a series, and the next one, and I can't see anyone, I can't remember the exact date, unfortunately, but the next one in this series, which I think is in a couple of weeks' time, is on the International Criminal Court. There will be a round table on the role of global civil society in the formation of the International Criminal Court, which is also a chapter in here. And on March the 6th, we'll have a round table on corporate social responsibility. So I hope you all come again. And let me give Saskia a really big thanks for this.